Good morning. My name is Clive Geraghty. I'm a member of the congregation here. And the opinions you hear this morning will be either my own or stolen from the most reliable sources. It's not unusual nowadays for people to live to be 100. And if we divide that 100 into 5 20-year segments, then I am definitely in the last tranche of my century. This sometimes surprises me. I don't welcome it. Certainly gives rise to slight apprehension, but it doesn't frighten me, although maybe it should. But it is part of the deal. If you want to be a part of this life, the wonderful experience of living in this mind-boggling world, in the awesome majesty of the universe, you must be prepared to leave it when your time is up. Into my heart an air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue remembered hills? What farms, what spires are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I went and cannot come again. Looking back, I can honestly say that I have had a charmed life. Not that there haven't been ups and downs, there have. Although my parents were poor, they knew how to survive. On a bus driver's miserable pay, they managed to buy their own house when I was 13. They'd started saving for the deposit the year I was born, an act of great optimism in the early days of World War II. I look back with some pleasure on most of my school days, happy days mostly, primary school only, under the sometimes oppressive care of the Christian Brothers. A spell in a technical school was followed by a tough few years as a technician in the Air Corps, until by chance I landed the job of my dreams as an actor, most of which I spent in the much derided Abbey Theatre. As well as earning a living there, I also was introduced to literature and was able to continue my education after a fashion. I made many mistakes, an early ill-advised marriage being probably the worst, with the longest lasting consequences. And I fell under the influence of the heavy drinking culture that was everywhere in the 1960s, especially in the arts. Going to an early opening pub for an eye-opener was not unheard of. I had a lucky escape from the clutches of the demon drink after a 15-year binge, but it was a damn close-run thing, as the man said. But someone somewhere was praying for me. In my late 30s, I was almost at the point of no return when I saw the signpost that said, "Live or die, it is up to you." Fuad Féin Atashe. Although I had parted company with the Catholic Church early in my life, it wasn't possible to make a clean break. For instance, in the army, we were marched to Mass and other church services. There was no point in telling the orderly officer that you didn't believe in this sort of thing anymore, and could you be excused Mass parade, please? And of course, when I had children of my own, it was impossible to escape the religious rites of passage that was part of their lives. But my inner spiritual search for a home was answered when I came in here for the first time. I was blown away by the freedom of thought and the lack of rubrics and set theology. I remember Bill Darlinson, our minister emeritus, saying in one or more of his always stimulating addresses, "I rule nothing out or nothing in." In one instance, I think the subject was the miracle of our individual creation. We heard how the average male produces up to 300 million sperm, but only one of them fertilizes the woman's egg. So if another sperm, other than the one that was responsible for your creation, got to the egg first, you would not be born. Maybe someone like you, but not you. What makes you, you? Your mind, the self, is the mind part of the brain, or is the brain just the tool of the mind? We emerge by a miracle out of the black depths of oblivion from unbeing to being. Through the miracle of conception and creation, we are fed and nurtured in the darkness of the womb until we are ready to emerge, to come aboard the raft of life, afloat on the river of life, with our spirit, self, or soul in place. From our first day in the light, we start to learn about ourselves, about our family, our kin, our clan, our tribe, our race, and our world. Little by little, we acquire the greatest of human skills, language, and we acquire the unique facility of being able to think about our thoughts. Then, sometime in our middle age, we come to realize that we humans learn something that no other species ever learns, namely that sometime, someday, we will die. Spengler said that from human fear in the presence of death proceeds every religion, every scientific investigation, and every philosophy, although Trotsky maintained that war is the engine of civilization. Is that when we get a soul, the moment of conception? Is there such a thing as a soul? As Philip Larkin said, "Oh God, if there is a God, have mercy on my soul if I have a soul." Is the soul just out there somewhere, just waiting for us to be born? What function has the mind or the self in the soul? What happens to the soul when someone gets dementia? Is it the self or the mind that suggests to us what we should do? When I was 65, something inside told me, or politely hinted, that maybe I should study Irish and Old Irish, the language spoken and written in Ireland from the 6th to the 9th centuries. I went to university when I was 68, and I've had nearly 20 years of great pleasure studying my native language. But where do ideas like that come from? As Bill once advised us, become a self-appointed inspector of a trivial pursuit. Christian churches talk a lot about the immortal soul. The Catholic Church was very fond of using the term, but usually when telling us of all the bad things, the sins that would condemn your immortal soul to everlasting pain and suffering, but they couched these descriptions in terms of this pain being inflicted on the human body, just to make sure we got the message. Does God exist? Or is it all what we call nature? The Lakota Indians of North America call him or it the great mystery. Martin Pulbrook put it most eloquently recently when he spoke of the one who made the wheel that turns the stars. And what was there before the Big Bang? I saw Professor Brian Cox recently explain that it is now believed that nothing existed. There was no matter before the Big Bang. Nothing existed in what he called the cosmic dark ages except space-time and a rippling ocean of energy and gases. So who lit the fuse that set off the Big Bang and converted energy into matter? Up to 1924, scientists believed that there was one galaxy, the Milky Way, and that that was the universe. Along came Edwin Hubble, who reckoned that there was a lot more to it than that. Astronomers now reckon that there could be 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe, and that each galaxy holds maybe 400 billion stars. They also believe that the galaxies furthest from us are traveling faster away from us into outer space than the nearer galaxies. And so vast is this space that they now think that our universe may be just part of a super universe, hundreds of billions of light years away, space without limits. We are witness to the greatest show on earth every night. But how many of us ever raise our heads after dark to look at the night sky? I've seen it suggested that if the Milky Way only appeared above us every 20 years, we would be booking our seats years in advance, and having seen it would regard the sight as the experience of a lifetime. Will there be any stars in my crown when the evening sun goeth down? When I wake with the blessed in the mansions of rest, will there be any stars in my crown? Excuse me. But we shouldn't examine the macro without having a look also at the micro. We need balance in our lives and arguments. So let us look at the common fruit fly, which is easier to say than to do. Usually they are just annoying little black dots that gad about just outside the focus of our eyes. They share 75% of the genes that cause disease in humans, and their genomes contain 132 million DNA base pairs, and so scientists love them. Biologists certainly find them indispensable in their studies of aspects of medical science because of the speed with which they reproduce. Why do they exist? The brain of the fruit fly is 1/1,000th the size of our brain, invisible to the naked eye. They have an eye which consists of 750 separate eyes, all linked together to detect the slightest movement, which is what makes it so hard to hit them with a rolled up newspaper. So why did nature, or God, go to the trouble of creating these creatures? One thing is sure. Mankind, with all its brilliance, all its wealth, all its scientific ingenuity, could not make a fruit fly, never mind one of its eyes, or even a hen's eye. We can't even make a functioning human eye. There are times when even the staunchest atheist must say, maybe there is a God of creation after all. As Bill said, we'll rule nothing out or in. Albert Einstein said that only two things were infinite: the universe and human stupidity. And he added that he wasn't too sure about the universe. Napoleon posited that in politics, stupidity is never a handicap. In Iran, in 1953, the Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, brought in reforms: social security, land reforms, higher taxes on the well-off. He also nationalized the Iranian oil industry, which was owned by British Petroleum. So the British and American governments, using MI6 and the CIA, engineered a coup. Mossadegh was arrested and imprisoned for 3 years and was then put under house arrest until he died. His political party was suppressed, and so ended democracy in Iran. The Shah was returned to his peacock throne and ruled until he was, in turn, overthrown by another despot, Ayatollah Khomeini. Iran has been a thorn in the flesh of American foreign policy ever since. 70 years ago, a border guard was killed at the frontier between Israel and Gaza. Moshe Dayan was a general in the Israeli army. You remember him, the fellow with the black eye patch. And he was later the Israeli Minister for Defense. So he came to give the oration at the funeral. And this is what he said as he foretold the violence to come. For years, they, the Palestinians, have been sitting in the refugee camps in Gaza. And before their eyes, we have been transforming the lands and villages where they and their fathers dwelt into our estate. Beyond the furrow of the border, a sea of hatred and desire for revenge is swelling, awaiting the day when serenity will dull our path. and 70 years later, Gaza exploded. Hamas wreaked death and destruction on the Israelis, and as always happens, they were repaid in kind 20-fold. We, as a nation, have got many things right. We've got a lot of things wrong, too. Just have to look at the state of our housing crisis or the state of the health service or the slithery sleevenism that still infects some areas of our political life. Remember last year when there was an uproar because the Russian Navy were lurking in our offshore waters and sending high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft over our skies, and we could do nothing about it because we had no crews for our handful of ships and no aeroplanes capable of going up to have a look at the bandits. There was an outcry in the papers and in the Doyle how disgraceful it was that we had to rely on the RAF and the British Navy to keep a watch for us, as they had been doing for donkey's years. Then the Russians retreated, and once again, normal service was resumed. The government didn't have to do anything after all. We wouldn't have to spend time and money buying planes and paying our sailors and soldiers a decent wage in order to stop them leaving as soon as their 3 years contract was up. And we could bask in our undefended neutrality again. It was fascinating last Sunday to hear Bridget quoting Frederick Douglass, the black anti-slavery campaigner, saying that he suffered no prejudice in Ireland because of the colour of his skin. Now, Douglass was, of course, meeting a very enlightened section of Irish society. But other forms of prejudice were alive and well in Ireland. In 1831, an education bill was brought in here establishing national schools. Two subjects could not be taught, the Irish language and Irish history. It was illegal to do so. All instruction in all subjects was in English, though 70% of the population only spoke Irish. This year, Australia had a referendum to give Aborigines the right to recognition as the first peoples of Australia in the Constitution, and to allow them to make representations on their own behalf to Parliament. The Australian people voted to defeat that proposal. I'll finish with a quote from Woody Allen. More than any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray that we have the wisdom to choose correctly.